This episode of the Coin World Podcast is brought to you by the Coin World Marketplace. The Coin World Marketplace is the safest way to buy and sell your coins and bullion. Order from the dealer of your choice and pay safely and securely using our escrow checkout. Visit coinworld.market to browse our inventory today. Welcome to the Coin World Podcast. Here are your hosts, Chris Bullfinch and Jeff Stark.
Welcome to the Coin World Podcast. I'm Chris Bullfinch.
And I'm Jeff Stark.
We have a great episode for you today. I sat down with Matt Dinger, the host of the Coin Show Podcast, which in May of this coming year will be celebrating 10 years of existence. He's been doing it since May of 2010. And he also operates the Lost Dutchman Coin Shop, which is located in suburban Indianapolis, Indiana. We had a really great conversation about podcasting, sort of a meta podcast on a podcast. We had a great conversation about podcasting and about the numismatic industry and coin collecting today.
Speaking of podcast, if you're listening to their podcast, you should be listening to our podcast and vice versa.
Absolutely.
But if you're listening to our podcast, and clearly you are, if you're hearing this right now,
you stumbled your way into it.
We would love for you to subscribe. That helps us out. We appreciate it. We want to have a future as pod people, and that's the only way we can do that is to get those numbers up. We want to see you here just about every week with all the news, fun, chatter from the numismatic hobby. Please find us on your preferred platform.
And also feel free to reach out to us. We love to hear from listeners, feedback on the episodes, questions that you want us to answer on the pod. If you want to ask us questions about ourselves, you could. I don't know why you would, but you can. So, yeah, but no, feel free to reach out.
I'm a Leo. I enjoy long walks.
And yeah, exactly. I'm a Capricorn. Maybe that's why this dynamic works so well.
Yeah.
So to expand on podcast as a theme, now that we've plugged ourselves.
Matt is co-host of The Coin Show.
He is co-host of The Coin Show. Say that five times fast. And
that.
You're right. So he's co-host of the Coin Show podcast. It's been going since May of 2010, and they will have, I think they're on 148 or 149 for the number of episodes.
Yes, right around 150 by the
so
time.
So yeah,
we
they'll
hear
they'll probably by the time you hear this, it might be 150 by New Year's or so. They'll probably have 150 episodes. So it's just him and him and his partner just chatting, who run the Lost Dutchman coin shop over in Indiana. And yeah, they just sort of do what we do, a version of what we do, different segments, different focus and stuff. But they, chat about coins and the hobby. So it's podcasts are, I think, their massive explosion in popularity, I think, demonstrates the versatility of the medium and almost anyone can have it. There's an odd democracy of it that, people become attracted to what they become attracted to in terms of podcasts, or they can seek out a podcast or multiple podcasts that address their interests. So the numismatic phase, one theme of what he and I talked about is that, there aren't that many coin collecting podcasts out there. There's The Coin Show, there's Coin Week's podcast, there's our podcast. There are a couple of others. I think if you look up coin collecting or something in Apple Podcasts, that's where I get mine. You might be able to find quite a few more, but there aren't a ton. So there's definitely room to produce more different kinds of content.
Absolutely, and that's one of the things we're looking to do. We're coming up on going to have done about 35, 36
This is 34, and yeah, I think we'll almost break 40 by the time the year is out.
And we didn't start until April.
Yeah.
And the show's been an evolution.
Yeah.
And we've had fun doing this. I know that for me, I listen to some business-related podcasts, and I play those while I'm sorting my coin collection.
Mm, yep.
So it's a nice crossover. I get to hear interviews with thinkers and learn about different areas while I'm engaged in this other relaxing thing. So
yeah, they make for not that I like to think of our podcast
as
in these
background
terms,
noise.
But yeah, I mean,
I think I sensed where you were going with this.
Yeah, I mean, but in a way, because I do the same thing. I'll throw on, like any self-respecting millennial Gen Zer, I listen to the New York Times podcast and a lot of news. My podcast consumption tends to be news and history. The Washington Post actually has a Retropod. It's about forget the name of the guy that hosts it, but it's a 5 to 10 minute deconstruction of just interesting little historical episodes that they research. It's you know, and there are a lot of others. There, you know, I listen to politics podcasts, all kinds of stuff.
I like Mike Rowe's, the way I heard it, the...
That Mike Rowe from Dirty Jobs?
Yes.
The show that used to be on the Discovery Channel?
Yes, yes.
That's great.
So he talks, it's like a podcast for the curious mind with a short attention span. It's like 10 minutes long, the way I heard it.
Curious mind with a short attention span. How'd they find out what my LinkedIn bio reads?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Podcasts, you know, certainly are here to stay, and we're already thinking about what we can do differently, better, more for 2020.
Oh yeah. Well, it's like you said earlier, it's an evolution like anything else, and it's cool, and we appreciate you guys, the listeners, to the extent that you've chimed in and you've kept on listening. You know, we do it for ourselves and for our work, but it's also rewarding to know that there are at least some people out there who like to listen. So
yeah, and we get to think through some issues that in the numismatic landscape of the day, and certainly we want to want to have you along board and
absolutely
chime in.
Yeah, no, very true. And something I love about the podcast, and it segues well into something I learned this week, is we're blessed to work in an industry, and at least I'm blessed to work in a job, and I'm sure you feel the same way, Jeff, where almost daily I learn something. Right? Like, there's nary a day that goes by that I don't find something new out about a coin, or I don't learn about some obscure new coin issue.
I haven't watched in a while. I don't really watch TV, but when I did, I watched Jeopardy, and I was just amazed at how many answers I knew because I read about it or learned about it because of a coin issue, whether it was, you know, a facet of European history, which, you know, when I was in high school, I wanted nothing to do with European history. American history, I loved it, ate it up. I did an AP class in it, but I didn't care so much about
it. I did not take AP US for political reasons that I shan't get into now, but... no, but that's true. And so, but what I learned this week researching this podcast, you know, we talked to Matt Denger, as you mentioned, and he runs Lost Dutchman Rare Coin. Now, I thought Lost Dutchman was, you know, some kind of an elliptical reference to the Flying Dutchman, you know, the story of the famous ghost ship. Turns out, as I learned, that actually is not the origin of Lost Dutchman. Lost Dutchman actually refers to a mine. It's thought to be in Arizona, but there are Lost Dutchman mines broadly. Are mines typically in the Old West, you know, could have talked about this with Fred Hollibird. I should have, next time I find myself talking to him, I'll be sure to ask him. They're basically lost mines, you know, a mine that is, you know, someone strikes a gold or a silver or a copper claim, you know, they drill down or something, and either the mine collapses or the claim is never fully excavated, or for whatever reason, the location of the mine is lost.
It may die with the person who discovered it.
Well, if you light the fuse of the dynamite wrong and you're still in the hole, your odds of survival aren't great.
I mean, the specific case to which you're referring,
yes.
You know, the legend, this is all supposition in the Superstition Mountains, that, you know, this guy, Jacob Waltz, had discovered this mine and was going there every time he needed money, right?
Yep.
So I mean, I remember learning little episode when I was like 8 or 10, reading the Buried Treasures of the Old West books.
Right. So you're right. The origin of the term Lost Dutchman is generally credited, though I'm sure there's some debate among scholars and historians. A German immigrant named Jacob Waltz, born in 1810, immigrated here sometime early mid-19th century. He's from Germany, but he's referred to as a Dutchman because before the unification of Germany in 1871, the term Dutchman was often used to refer to people from the Netherlands and Germany.
Well,
it was a much more generally used term.
And there's a relation or a connection here. The Pennsylvania Dutch were called that. They're German heritage, right? And the scrubby Dutch, but that was because Deutsch, D-E-U-T-S-C-H, and that got Americanized
Dutch. Yep.
And so
Pennsylvania Germans is the actual more accurate term.
Correct. But that usage of Deutsch turned into Dutch.
Yep.
And that's why you have the lost Dutchman who was a German in Arizona.
Right. So in Arizona, in as you allude to, the Superstition Mountains, which I think is just a spectacular name for a mountain range. It's a little bit east. It's near the town of Apache Junction, which is a little bit east of Phoenix, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this mountain range, supposedly, Jacob Waltz apparently struck a claim that was never found. Now, what's interesting is this was actually recorded at the time. There were allusions to the Lost Dutchman mine as early as the 1870s. And by the early 1890s, there were actually people who dedicated some amount of their time to looking for it. In fact, it's been estimated that thousands of people have actually conducted various expeditions, some I imagine pretty amateurish, some a little bit more considered.
And people still go out there today. And people die today looking for it.
There's a state park. There's the Lost Dutchman State Park in Arizona. So the legend persists, and, you know, I think it's a good name for a coin shop because it's an allusion to the fact that, you know, you'll find the treasure you're looking for here at the Lost Dutchman Coin Shop.
As an aside related, the American Numismatic Association Spring Convention, the National Money Show, was in Phoenix several years ago. And I was fortunate enough to go out there then. I think it was 2009, actually. It may have been 10 years ago. There is a cemetery in downtown Phoenix where Jacob Vault is buried. So
really?
I went there and saw where the quote-unquote Lost Dutchman is buried.
I think he died sometime in the 1890s. And yeah, so it's an interesting story. And it's a fascinating little nugget from history that the Lost Dutchman Coin Shop in Indianapolis, from which it gets its name. So
it is interesting, though, that you have a coin shop in Indianapolis area named for something that happened in Arizona.
Yeah.
That is fun. That is funny. But you know what also happened in Arizona? We have a letter from a reader who was out in Arizona. This is actually from 1995.
We've decided to plumb the depths of old coin worlds and continue a segment we sort of started last week.
We're looking at the week that was, and we wanted to see what was happening in numismatics around this time in the past. So we went to the November 20th, 1995 issue, where a John Wilburn of Apache Junction, Arizona, was writing in. And Mr. Wilburn, this speaks to the idea that the more things change, the more they stay the same. I've said that before. Collectors perennially complain about coin designs, and that's what Mr. Wilburn's beef was in this case. He says, terminate the worthless cent and mint a new 90% silver dollar coin, the same size as a cent, but slightly thicker with a reeded edge. Why mint billions of throwaway cents when millions of new silver dollars could be struck on the cent presses each year? There would be no major mint retrofitting cost and count the cost saved by not minting cent coins. He's quite adamant and ends with the question, do you favor a new small silver dollar coin replacing the 1 cent coin? So 1995, this idea that we have to get rid of the 1 cent coin is...
It's been around a while.
Well, I mean, you think about it, it was 1857 the last time the U.S.
changed the size of the cent.
Yes, they got rid of the half cent and then the large cent went from large to smaller.
We've had the small cent for well over 150 years.
It's time to get rid of it if there's a political will for it.
Yep. Oh, I completely agree. There's no reason to keep it. A number of letters are published in these things. We just pick out a couple that we think are interesting. This one I love. It's from a man named Terrence E. Carpenter from Oceanside, California. The letter reads, I collect coins, and my wife, Delzira, it's a really interesting spelling, I'll put it in the show notes, and maybe you guys can figure out how to pronounce it, likes to spend them. No problem. Opposites attract. I was reading the article about the new design of the $100 bill. The $100 bill had some updates to its design in the mid-90s. The $100 bill. I really don't care much about the change because I'm not a, quote, rag picker, unquote. I showed the picture to Delzira and made the remark, I do not care much for it. To which he replied, I've never seen a $100 bill that I did not like. So much for that. His final comment, though, is what really made this stand out. I like Coin World, he says. Except for Q. David Bowers, I believe some of the writers and readers of Coin World take things too seriously. Coin collecting is supposed to be fun, and that is what I'm having. So, apparently he felt that some of the folks at our fine publication were altogether too serious in his view, which I thought was very funny. But in late November of 1995, the big headline, so we're talking about letters to the editor, the big headline was that apparently a Civil War memorialization or history organization apparently managed to summon enough political will in Congress to get the surcharges from the Civil War Battlefield Half Eagle, which was issued by the U.S. Mint in 1995. Apparently surcharges from that commemorative coin were taken from the original intended recipient, which was the Civil War Trust, and gave it to the Association for the Preservation of Civil War Sites Incorporated, a totally different organization. So when the legislation was originally passed creating the coin, the surcharges, and as we've talked about commemorative coins, the surcharges that are collected from the sale of those coins are often donated to an organization, typically an organization which either sponsors or proposes the legislation. So apparently there's quite a hoopla over this when the money was taken from the Civil War Trust and given to a different organization. Our editor, Beth Deischer, in her editorial from that week, described it as despicable. So there was a little bit of controversy going on in the numismatic world. It was all covered by CoinWorld in an issue from November 20th, 1995.
Now we're going to stay back in time a little bit. We're going to go further back, though, in this week in history, because on November 20th of 1861, now this is a callback to an earlier edition of the CoinWorld podcast. Last week's edition, actually, when we interviewed Mr. Beerley on the In God We Trust motto, because on November 20th of 1861, that is when the Treasury Secretary, Salmon P. Chase, instructed the then Mint director by the name of James Pollock. Chase told Pollock that he had to put a motto, to incorporate a motto honoring a deity on U.S. coins. That motto would turn out to be In God We Trust. The ball got rolling, if you will, for that. This week in history, November 20th of 1861.
Oh, there you go. So quite a few things were unfolding in November, back in history.
So we've been telling you the information. Now we have to ask you the information, right? So last week...
Yeah, we certainly do.
...was a trivia question. We're doing this once a week now, as before, but we're waiting to give you time to think about
giving
this. Weigh in on Facebook, if you will.
Giving you the cliffhanger.
That's right. That's when Cliff Clavin is hanging off a cliff.
Something like that. Is that from Reading Rainbow?
No, Cliff Clavin was from Cheers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That was from Cheers, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Not to be confused with Cliff Huxtable, who is a whole other ball of wax.
There was also a segment about someone hanging off a cliff in the children's show Reading Rainbow back a long time ago. Also,
take a look. It's in a book.
Reading Rainbow. You know what's funny, though? Do you know the name of the bar that Cheers was the exterior shots of the show Cheers, the bar that they go to? Do you know what bar that is in Boston?
It's the Bullfinch.
It's the Bull and Finch Pub. Everyone in my family has every branch of my family has at least one poster of the Bull and Finch Pub somewhere in our house.
Okay.
Anyway, fun little piece of
trivia. We're going to leave the pub and go to church because the question last week was, what was the purpose of the now rare Albany, New York church pennies?
Mm-hmm.
So what is a church penny? What purpose could they serve? Why did they exist? These are among the annals of early American coinage.
Having dug into it a little bit, because I actually had never heard of Albany church pennies, so I did some digging, and apparently in 1790, the copper coins that were being put onto the collection plate when it was passed around at this church in Albany, apparently the coins were too worn to be able to be positively identified or to be evaluated or to be confirmed to be authentic. So this organization decided to mint their own little pennies that they could use, and it was a sort of a mechanism with which to solicit donations. They minted about 1,000 of them in 1790, and the reason that they did, as I mentioned, was because the coins that they were receiving for donations had worn too much.
Yes, this was the answer, according to the CoinWorld trivia game, officially says to keep worn and counterfeit coppers out of the collection plates of the First Presbyterian Church.
First Presbyterian Church in Albany, New York. So that is an Albany church penny.
So we're going to do another callback. That was a callback to last week's episode.
Yep.
Our trivia question for this week is a callback to many episodes ago, and actually the topic we talked about, but we didn't give the answer then. So this is a tough one. This is expert-level question.
So be a brain teaser.
So who bought the original Confederate half-dollar discovery piece in the 1880s?
All right.
We had an interview with George Correll about Confederate cents and all the Confederate money.
The issue was raised.
So this is a real stumper. I've heard of this guy's name before, but I didn't realize he was involved in the Confederate story, the Confederate half story. So think about it. And we're going to have the answer next week, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And in the interim, please enjoy the interview that we had with Matt Dinger, where we talk about podcasts, and you can hear a little bit about his process and about the show that he's hosted for roughly the last 10 years. So please enjoy the interview. All right. I am lucky to be joined by Matt Dinger, who's a coin dealer based out of Indianapolis, Indiana, the owner and operator of Lost Dutchman Rare Coins, and the host of The Coin Show, a podcast that has been running since 2010. Thanks so much for joining us, Matt.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, as a fellow podcaster, I'm curious, you've been doing this for almost a decade now. Tell us a little bit about how you started The Coin Show and what you think the best content that could be produced through podcast or through audio mediums for numismatists might be.
Okay, the Coin Show was started you were right, 2010. We were actually, Mike and I were on the coin forum Coin Talk, and somebody had brought up the fact that there really weren't any coin podcasts. And that kind of put a spark in my mind that, maybe we should try to do something like this. So we kind of organized ourselves through the Coin Talk website, and then from there we started putting out shows, and 10 years later, here we are. And then as far as the question about bringing information to people and content to people through audio, it's a challenge that we've always faced, I think. Numismatics and coin collecting in general is such a very visual and tactile, hobby that it is really hard to convey a lot of things through just a podcast. It's been a challenge and definitely something we still continue to kind of work with all the time.
Sure. And I'm curious, not only as a, given that we're on a podcast right now, as a podcaster for Coin World and just more broadly, where do you find is the best area to focus, given that it's an audio-based medium? What is the most valuable information that a podcast can convey as opposed to a print publication or, an online forum, a website? What can podcasts do uniquely for the numismatic industry? What can we do with a podcast that we might not be able to do in another medium?
I think with audio and, with the actual general discussion that happens on a podcast, I think that conveying more emotion or more a general sense of understanding the nuances in what I'm saying versus maybe just if I'm trying to make a point while somebody is reading what I've written, it's a little different because you can judge what I'm saying about something. I might be, kind of speaking between the lines, and you can pick that up a little easier, I think, in an audio format versus, say, a print format.
Right, that makes sense. It's a little bit more personalized. There's a more of a human element to it than you might get in a more drier or less personal or human medium. Do you ever run out of material? I mean, maybe I'm asking this a little bit out of my own self-interest. There are countless topics that we can, discuss about numismatics and that can be, considered in the hobby space and in media produced for the hobby. But do you find yourself running up against any walls? And what content do you find engages the audience best? What do you find people tend to seek out or respond really well to?
Sure. Our first about 70 or 80 episodes, we actually would pick a topic every episode, and either myself or Mike would kind of write up something about that topic. We would discuss the topic, kind of present our presentation and then have a little discussion about it. After that, we started realizing, hey, we've already covered this once and we just did it again. Maybe we should think about doing something else. But we actually found that the most engaging thing, at least for our audience, has been, just what's the news in the world of numismatics, basically, covering interesting things coming up at auction, interesting stories throughout U.S. and world numismatics, new releases. And then also one of the favorites is we have a segment called What Walked In. And basically, it is a segment of the coolest thing to come into my office between our recordings. So it's been a fan favorite. Everybody loves it. I get to talk about literally everything. It's fun because I really never know what it's going to be from episode to episode. So that's probably, I would say, the fan favorite.
No, it's almost like a numismatically focused edition of Pawn Stars. You know that show on the History Channel? There's a little bit of an element of mystery here. So you started in coins at a very young age. What attracted you to coin collecting, and what do you think the hobby could do better to attract a younger crowd?
Oh, that's a good question. Yes, I did. I started, I think I was 9 years old when I first started collecting. And for me, it was really just you take a piece of history and hold it in my hand and think, oh, okay, well, you know, like most coin collectors think, you know, who had this? Where has it been? You know, what was it used for? And I think that really is what kind of drew me into it. And then from there, it was about discovering, you know, all the different aspects of numismatics, you know, world coins, ancient coins, paper money, even exonumia, you know. And from there, it kind of grew into an obsession, like with most coin collectors, I think. Then I guess the rest is history. And as far as bringing kids and young people into the hobby and maybe engaging them a little more, I think at this particular point, technology might have a lot to do with it. I think that if we can find a way to engage kids on their level, because today we're in such a technology-driven world that, you know, kids wish a happy 8th birthday and handed a cell phone or a tablet, you know, I think that if we can get on that level somehow, I think that might be a way to bring kids into numismatics and also kind of engage that same enjoyment that I found as a kid, you know, thinking about the history and just, wow, this is really cool, and thinking about almost like the cool factor. I think if we can engage the technology and the cool factor, I think we can reel some kids in.
Absolutely. And my experience with being a young person in the hobby echoes yours. So I absolutely think you're right about that. And I also think that experience is common to a lot of numismatists. But I'm curious, you opened your coin shop, or a coin shop, at the age of 22. Is that the same? Yep. Was that Lost Dutchman that you opened at 22, or has it changed since then?
So Lost Dutchman actually was my local shop. It started in the 80s through a gentleman that I dealt with as a kid. I used to go into the store when I was 8, 9, 10 years old. He just decided one day that he was done. He wanted to retire. He was either going to sell the shop or close the shop. And he, because throughout the years as a kid, as a teenager, I was always saying, hey, when are you going to give me a job? When are you going to, you know, let me work here? I want to do this. So one day he just called me up and said, hey, I know you've been asking for a job for a long time, but this is a little more than that. What do you think about it? From there, the rest is kind of history. We bought it and have been just expanding and growing ever since.
Well, as a 23-year-old in the hobby, I have to say it's pretty impressive that a 22-year-old in the hobby those years ago took on ownership of a coin shop. For people interested who...
It was an eye-awakening experience going from flipping burgers to running a coin shop.
I imagine those require two different skill sets, though you still are dealing with things that are round and flat, so...
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So you have that sort of degree of similarity, but I can imagine that taking on that kind of a responsibility, you know, at a young age was, like you said, quite an eye-opening experience. In that same vein, do you have any advice for someone who, either a young person interested in trying to open a shop or setting up at a show, or someone, whether on the younger side or the older side, but since you started at a young age, I think it makes sense to speak to the experience of younger folks. You know, do you have any advice for people who want to start getting out there and buying and selling coins, if not professionally, then at least as a hobby, or professionally? You can speak to whichever side of that you want to.
Well, as a coin dealer, the professional side really speaks a little more to me, I think, than the personal side. But I can hit on both. As far as the coin dealer side of it goes, I think that the first and most important thing about selling coins is building relationships with other dealers that you trust. Building relationships with these kind of people will really help you throughout your career, especially if you can maintain these relationships over the years. One of the most important things to me was early on, I had a couple of dealers that took me under their wing, that took me to shows with them, and I would just kind of sit back and observe and learn. And I think those are some of the most shaping experiences of my career, you know, just being at a show like Fun a year after opening a coin shop and going and setting up at a table of Fun just really kind of changed my perception of the hobby itself. And then as far as people that just want to get into collecting, I mean, we say on our show, collect what you like. I mean, it doesn't matter if you like Lincoln Cents with reverse die rotation or if you're buying, you know, the top Pop Morgan silver dollars. Collect what you like. And that's just something I've always said. I say that to my customers all the time. I say that on the show all the time. It's just kind of the way that I live in numismatics. Collect what you like.
Well, it seems like that might be the only way to live, right? I mean, if you're not collecting something you're interested in, then you're not probably going to have all that positive an experience, right? Because you aren't interested in what you're doing.
But we actually see a lot of people that in the office, they come to me and say, okay, well, I put this set together, and they almost sound like they're finishing up their set, and they're almost like kind of like, okay, well, what am I going to do? It's almost like a chore. And when it becomes a chore to collect, then it's not really collecting anymore. It's just a chore. So it's I always tell people that you have to still be able to get enjoyment out of it, because once your enjoyment runs out, what's the point?
Where do you feel that line exists between collecting as a labor of love or a joy or something like that, and collecting as a chore? Because it seems that as a dealer, when coins become your living, it almost becomes just a job. I mean, is that a very sort of bright, clearly defined line, or do you find that it's sort of more nebulous? Do you find that, you know, you are obviously probably still interested in coins, but you just happen to do it professionally, or you're doing it professionally? How do you walk that line? Where do you see that line, and how do you sort of relate to it?
Well, for me, I live vicariously as a collector through my customers. I love to help finish collections when they're really excited about them. I love to help people put together registry sets and compete that way. It's just, that is how I collect these things. I collect the experience of helping people do what they want to do. And for me, that's just as satisfying as collecting a coin or a set of coins myself.
So in that way, sort of the customer-dealer relationship becomes sort of a, not a joint collection because one person owns it, but your role in helping people to assemble a collection is you're almost collecting that experience in some way. Is that a sort of a fair analysis?
Sure. Yeah, we get to help them, you know, strategize. We get to help them kind of pick their direction, and this is really at their, you know, at their request. But you know, we get to kind of advise them on which direction, if it was ours, we would go, and then from there they can make their own decisions. And it's just fun to somebody go from having four Morgan Silver dollars just randomly to putting together a complete registry set of them. That's just the best part, and it's fun. It's fun to watch their progress and watch them learn, and you know, be able to teach them from our experience over the years.
So in that way, a dealer almost becomes a teacher. There's sort of, you could almost have a numismatic, you know, outside of the ANA summer seminar or something like that, you could almost have sort of a coin dealer curriculum that you could put together and, you know, teach people the basics, or at least watch people learn. So in that way, I imagine being a coin dealer has a little bit of the element of, you know, a teacher in it, right?
Well, it should. If you're really passionate about what you do, it definitely should. I know a lot of, not every coin dealer is obviously in it for the experience like we are, but I think that if you really do care about the hobby and do care about, you know, bringing collectors in and helping collectors make sure that they stay collectors in the future, I think that should definitely be a priority.
In terms of the health of the hobby, you know, you talk about how people come in, they express their interests in different series, and you help them put things together. What do you find that people are most interested in, and do you find that, at least in your roughly, you know, rough decade-ish of experience, you know, have you noticed a significant shift in what people are interested in? And have you noticed a shift in the number of people interested in coins more broadly?
I think that in general, these days, a lot of people, I mean, obviously with the bullion markets being what they are, they first and foremost look at coins as an investment, which is kind of a double-edged sword, I think. If you're really, truly just collecting what you like, it shouldn't necessarily matter all that much. But a lot of people do look at their coin collections as a very planned out and strategic investment. And, you know, that I've noticed that quite a bit more. But as far as the coins and markets themselves seem to be, you know, going well, it's normally, you know, you're kind of your standard Lincoln Penny, Morgan Dollar. Those are kind of the, you know, the guys that are the bread and butter of a coin shop. Then you have, you know, obviously your other series do have, you know, people that are interested in them, but the Morgan Dollars and the Lincoln Cent guys are kind of the guys that, you know, started collecting like I did as a kid and continue to this day collecting. So,
yeah, that makes sense. To return to the podcast as a theme to kind of tie these two areas together, being a dealer and being a podcaster, do you find that a podcast makes for an effective medium for dealers or experts to communicate their knowledge? And what do you think we could all do? You know, you could do, we at CoinWorld could do, other podcasters in the numismatic space. What could we do to make sure that a message about good information and good collecting practices, how do we expand our reach into into the, you know, the quote unquote mainstream, right? You know, how do we get our message out there in a place where people can actually find it and make use of it?
That's a good question. And that's always something that we consider when we're producing our content. We have just recently started to supplement our podcast with videos on Facebook, on YouTube, on Instagram, you know, all these other kind of social media platforms. It does definitely help when you can provide people with a visual aid, especially if you're talking about a specific series or coin itself even. But as far as, you know, bringing it to the mainstream, I just think that the way that entertainment is kind of jumping away from the mainstream these days might just make it mainstream in itself. You know, my kids, I have three kids, and they hardly ever watch TV. They're always watching content on YouTube. They're watching their, you know, guys on YouTube. They like to watch their videos every day. And I think that as this younger generation kind of, the digital generation kind of keeps, you know, looking for entertainment, for content, I think that just being out there and being unique and providing, you know, a sense of good, accurate, and entertaining information, I think that might just make it mainstream in itself at some point.
Right. So it has everything to do with presentation. It has a lot to do with creating content that can engage a broad audience that might not rely specifically on numismatic information. Like you said in one of your earlier answers, something that attracted you as a kid to coin collecting, and the very same impulse attracted me, was that feeling of holding history in your hands. And you mm-hmm. know, and that phrase, I think, has a lot of cachet out in the numismatic industry. But it does sometimes feel as though it's tough to get, quote-unquote, mainstream recognition. That's a term that's kind of fraught. But, you know, it does seem like it can be tough to break into that. So I think you're right on that. What's the future of your podcast, of podcasting in general in the numismatic space? What do you hope to do with the podcast? And, you know, do you hope to change it much in the next, you know, foreseeable future? Are you happy where it is? What are you looking at in the future?
Well, when we started this podcast, it was really just, we kind of said to ourselves, we said, hey, you know, me and you are just going to sit here and talk to each other and people are going to find it interesting. I'm not sure that that's going to work, but it seems like it has. It's one of those things that if it's not broke, I don't plan on fixing it. I can always add to it. We've been producing more content as far as visual content goes and as far as even specific audio content. You know, every episode we ask our listeners, you know, what do you want to talk about? Send us a question. We take questions and we'll answer them, you know, right here on the show. So it's just a matter, I think, of engaging people and maybe speaking to your listener. And I think that as far as our show changing, I don't know. It's always been kind of a labor of love for us. We enjoy doing it. Both Mike and I have both had things come up where we've had to take breaks from recording. And it's just a matter of we both really do enjoy doing it. And if we can continue to enjoy doing it, we'll keep doing it forever. You know, Mike's one of my best friends in the whole planet. So we definitely enjoy each other's company. We can sit and talk for hours. So why not just continue what we're doing? It seems to be that people like it. And if we can supplement it with others, then that's great as well.
Well, it does seem like that connection that you guys have and that connection you guys have with the audience and everything like that, that really is the secret sauce to making an engaging and successful podcast. So, you know, we'll definitely take notes, and, you know, I look forward to you know, keeping up with your podcast and seeing what you guys do in the future. So anyway, Matt, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today. I think this is a really good interview, one that I think our listeners will be interested in, especially two podcasters talking about the ins and outs of the creative process and things like that. So thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time.
No, and I appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
That was Chris's interview with Matt Dinger, co-host of the Coin Show podcast. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. If you are enjoying it, please subscribe however you get your podcast. Reach out to us. We want to hear from you.
Yeah, we do.
We're always looking to interact with fellow collectors and share what you are excited about in the hobby. Until next time,
happy collecting.
Thank you for listening to the Coin World Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and we'll see you next week. Send us your questions and feedback on Facebook at facebook.com/coinworld or on Twitter @coinworld. Be the first to know about our next episode by signing up for our newsletter. Go to coinworld.com and click on free newsletter to sign up today. This episode of the Coin World Podcast was brought to you by the Coin World Marketplace. All the safety, trust, and convenience you'd expect from Coin World. With over 40,000 coins available, visit coinworld.market to explore our inventory today.